Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Caregiving is one of the toughest, most emotional experiences we can have, and it's becoming a numbers issue of staggering proportions. In the past year, more than 43 million Americans provided unpaid care to family members. And as if it weren't difficult enough, as the population ages, the pool of care providers will decrease. With me in studio to talk about caregiving are Dr. Deborah Phelps, professor of sociology at Fontbonne University, and author of Frank's Arms, Stories and Lessons from a Caregiver and Patient Advocate. It's a memoir on time she spent caring for her late husband. She holds a doctorate in social psychiatry from Yale. Jamie Centner is a licensed clinical social worker who counsels on coping with grief and stress management. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Debbie, let me begin with you. In saying that caregiving is one of the toughest jobs out there, is that overstating the issue?
That's an excellent question. Yes and no. I mean, you do it out of love and out of devotion, and you do it almost on, or at least I did almost on autopilot. But at the same time, it's emotionally, financially, physically draining. And then depending on the severity of the person you're caregiving for, it can manifest in all kinds of ways.
Well, we often hear that cases like this, that care needs to be given to the caregiver in most cases.
Definitely. Self-care, I learned that very early on, is paramount to my well-being, the patient's well-being, and the outcome of the treatment.
Right. We'll talk more about self-care in your case in a moment, but Jamie, you were nodding when I talked about care for the caregiver. And I guess that's something that you deal with what you do.
Sure. And when I do grief trainings with other therapists who work in the field of caregiving, hospice, grief work, it's the number one thing that we push is caring for yourself, because we're not good at what we want to be good at if we're not in a good place ourselves. And that's so much easier said than done. I mean, I say that with complete respect to how difficult it can be to have downtime and spiritual time. And
of course, you're preoccupied with the issue at hand, which
sure.
makes it even more.
Sure.
So give me an example of what people can do in this self-help category.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand themselves and know what they need. Some people know that the nighttime is the hardest time because they're supposed to lay down and shut off. And that's when you're thinking about your most difficult cases or the things at work that are troubling you. And so sometimes it's just teaching somebody how to settle down at bedtime. You know, I'm sure that when you would go home from caring for Frank, if you went home at the end of the day, your head was filled with questions that you should have asked, wanted to ask. And that's a hard time of day to shut off. So teaching people meditation, teaching people counting, teaching people, you know, other interventions, listening to soft music, taking a bath, just knowing that you matter. A large percentage of grief work when somebody's grieving is self-compassion, being kind to yourself, knowing that you're not the same person that you were before this crisis struck you.
When you speak of grieving, you're talking of grieving during this process, before
sure.
before the patient would pass away.
Sure.
Because that is a period of grief. Debbie, give me some sense of how you handled it.
How I handled which aspect?
The caregiving and this whole process of caring for yourself, the self-help.
The self-help, I was into that before Frank became ill. All kinds of energy and body work. So it was sort of second nature to take care of myself throughout. I mean, I took trips. I got massages. I went to Sedona, Arizona. Early on, Frank went with me on those trips. It was just self-indulgent kinds of taking care of yourself activities, anything I could learn and do that could help Frank and help myself at the same time through the process. And also, I'm excellent at compartmentalizing my emotions and fixing whatever needs to be fixed at the moment. So I was focused, and I had to be hypervigilant because he had the autoimmune disorder, scleroderma, and it's a complicated condition where multiple systems are compromised, and we had to have excellent and sophisticated practitioners. So I was sort of the helicopter, you know, hypervigilant person that was with him constantly watching, fixing, doing, resolving. And I could do it because that's a skill I have. It comes to me naturally.
When did he pass away?
2005.
So it's been a while. How well have you done since then?
Well, I mean, the same kind of things, the same activities that I did while he was ill, I continued after, learning new things, traveling, friends, family. It's slow. I mean, it took me a long time to be okay with my solitude. In the beginning, the loneliness was almost too much to bear. So I stayed busy reading novels, shopping, going to movies multiple times a week, anything I could do to finally be okay with my solitude. And then just in the last few years, I adopted a shelter cat that keeps me company. But it was a long, slow process. It's simply not easy.
Well, I certainly understand and appreciate how it would not be. Jamie, it sounds like Debbie has handled this very well.
Well, you know, well is a relative term. I think that we like to say, how are you doing with your grief? And what does well mean? Yeah, she's functioning. And yeah, she knows herself really, really well. And she knows what she needs to relax and to feel whole. I think for her, the book helped a lot with her grief process because it helped her to process the myriad of aspects of this caregiving. And because she wrote it after Frank died, obviously, it helped her along with her grief process in terms of thinking about what it was that her future was going to look like.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about some aspects of the book now, Debbie, as advice to people who might be going through this or who might soon be going through it, because you have a lot of practical advice in it that people would not normally think about, I would guess. And that would be navigating the medical bureaucracy. You have some interesting thoughts in there about dealing with physicians, firing physicians. And actually, you talk about being a kind of a helicopter mom here. You have to be tough, don't you?
Oh, yes. And the toughness wore on me over time. I really got tired of pushing, getting results. But in a bureaucracy, sometimes it's just what you have to do. If Frank was in need of something, ailing, hurting, then it was my job to fix it, to get it done. And one example might be he went in for a routine gallbladder surgery. And what we thought was going to be routine, but when they cut into him, they found that he was hardened pretty much on the inside, and they had to take the gallbladder and then reconstruct bile ducts from his intestines. And as he was coming up out of the surgery, went into cardiac arrest. And so instead of, as they were taking the breathing tube out, he went into cardiac arrest. So the medical team assumed that removing the breathing tube was what was associated with the heart stopping. And they put him in ICU, and they had decided they were not going to take out the breathing tube until they were sure he was stabilized, maybe until the next day. And he had so much anesthesia he couldn't move, but when I went into his ICU room, when he could finally move his eyes, he was communicating to me to help him because he pointed to his head and turned it. No, I want this out. So it took me quite a while, and I had to go through this chain of command to reach somebody that would at least give him the benefit of the doubt and remove the tube rather than keep it in him with no sedation. So I kept saying to people, you either got to sedate him or take it out. And finally, they agreed that if he was stable 20 more minutes, they'd take it out and see what happened. And when they removed the tube, he was fine. He said, thank you. I felt like I was smothering. But it was my persistence to go through the chain of command, to keep pushing. Or when he was in the rehab center and they didn't change his diaper and give him a bath and those kinds of things, I had to get... And that went counter to my nature, and after a while, that wore on me.
Well, what's your best advice to people to how to do this? I mean, it was against your nature. It probably is against the nature of most people.
My advice is just to be persistent, ask questions. If something doesn't seem right to you, talk to them about what their plans are, the practitioners. Communicate. Communication is key. Teamwork. Trusting and believing one another. You know, you want to have teamwork with the patient, which was my husband. And the two of us have separate roles, but they're complementary in having hopefully a easier outcome, treatment outcome. So, yeah, use your own judgment. But the biggest thing I think I learned early on is to take care of yourself at all costs.
Part of it, too, is really having some knowledge of what is going on.
Well, there's that.
Yes, but I mean, that's easier said than done. You're dealing with medical professionals, and you're not.
Well, I was a medical sociologist, which gave me the, you know, the confidence to question, to know that there's politics here. These are people, you know, that science sometimes is an art, or medicine sometimes is an art. So I was confident. I probed, I pushed, I asked, you know.
Jamie, let me bring you into this. What are you thinking when you hear this? This is not exactly your bag, as it were, this part of, or is it?
Well, what I find so interesting about Debbie and our work together is that she advocates for herself with me as we do her grief work in much the same way that she advocated for Frank. She's not quiet about what she's asking for. Mm-hmm. And I'm never the expert. I am guided by what somebody else needs, and I listen to what she's saying. So I don't come in each session saying, oh, well, because of last time, or what I've been thinking is, I go to where she is right now. And that's she employed those same techniques when she was in the hospital. She would go in each day and assess the situation right now, and then impresses me about her. She advocates for herself and for her husband, you know, in the same way with me.
But here's what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing, however. I mean, we all know that Debbie is extremely well-educated and has learned through this awful ordeal, you know, how to deal with this sort of thing. But that's not everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not me,
right,
and it's not a lot of people who are listening right now. How do you get them to the point where they can be that kind of an advocate for self and for their loved one?
I think that if they know that they cannot just sit back and let life happen to them, let his illness happen to her, let the grief process happen to her, you can't be a passive person in all of this. And speaking up is hard, but listening to your instincts are even harder. And so when you encourage someone to pay attention to the fact something doesn't feel right here, I'm listening to me, and that's what's guiding my questions. And not everybody is comfortable with that, but maybe you have to experience that there are some things that happen when you stay silent, and you learn from those as teachable moments, those mistakes.
I have to take a break, but Debbie, one thing I did want to get to before that was in this area of being tough and being an advocate. You talk about firing physicians. That's something that does not occur to most people I know, a physician holds such a status in our society. How do you do that?
You just simply fire them. You say, I don't want your services anymore, but it's not easy. I didn't have the experience to do that, or it wasn't necessary in my case. I just wanted to give tips to other caregivers that should it come to that, you can do that. Mm-hmm. You can also keep residents out of the ICU room. But the problem is, if somebody's in an acute situation, if they're in a traumatic situation, you're not going to have the means to fire your physician. You're sometimes often at the luck of the draw. Mm. But I just wanted people to know that you can, because it's just something I learned in my med sociology training, that to tell people that. It didn't happen in our case, but we could if we needed to. And that was comforting to know I could do that if I needed to.
And I do have to take that break, but you did mention getting other attending physicians, students, for instance, out of the room. You can do that.
Yep. You can do that. And I didn't know that. An ICU nurse told me that.
And what's the advantage of that?
Some peace or space. The issue was Frank had a rare disorder that's particularly rare in males. And trainees were learning. And so when the lead doctor would leave the room, the attendees were waiting in the hall, or not the attendees, but the trainees were waiting in the hall to come in to repeat what the lead doctor just did, and there was this barrage of people coming in and out and in and out. And my husband was wonderful about it. He was good-natured. As many times as they wanted to check his vitals, it was fine. But after a while, it just gets to be too much. You need a little space. So the ICU nurse mentioned to me, you know, you can keep them out of the room. I didn't know.
I would have to think in cases like that, you'd look upon the patient as sort of a guinea pig.
Yeah,
you know, that
that's
exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
They're learning. It's a lesson plan. I have to take that break now. We're talking about caregiving, and my guests in studio are Deborah Phelps, professor of sociology at Fontbonne University, and also the author of Frank's Arms, Stories and Lessons from a Caregiver and Patient Advocate. Also with us in studio is Jamie Centner, licensed clinical social worker. Back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, perhaps you have questions about this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer a tweet, we'll take one at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Deborah Phelps and Jamie Centner. Debbie, let me come back to you. What's your best advice to people put in this caregiver situation?
Just to be open, to communicate to all parties, to look at it as teamwork rather than saving or rescuing. It's a teamwork that the patient has full voice in what's happening or going on, to trust and believe in one another. Taking care of yourself, which I've said already, to role model confidence, strength, and determination, because that reflects, the energy reflects onto the patient, who then feels more confident. Ask questions, keep asking questions. Theoretically, the more questions you ask, the better off you are in terms of the treatment you're going to get and the outcome, so that you understand that everybody is on a level playing field, that you promote mutual participation. You're an active participant in your health care or your loved one's health care. All parties are informed. All parties are honored. And ask for help. It's okay to ask for help. And the people around you hopefully will offer help, little things, a gift, a phone call, a hug. It goes a long way.
Let me just stop you there, if I may,
because
we had a communication today from one of our listeners named Michelle, who wrote in conjunction with she's taking care of her dad. And she is basically saying that the friends can play an awfully big role, both positive and negative. And that she is saying here, when things go wrong, please reach out. I might not need anything at the moment you call, but keep checking on us. Respond to that, and then I'll have Jamie do the same thing. It seems to me like that's pretty good advice.
I think that's very good advice. Yeah, friends and family are important. Extended family, friends, very, very important.
But Jamie, they can overdo it. They can maybe come in when they're not necessarily wanted.
Right. I just read the book, Option B, and one of the things she talks about is treating people with the platinum rule. You treat others how they would like to be treated. You know, like, so you're listening to what they want. And when people want to overdo it, you have to be careful to say, we're good right now, but would you check back with me in a couple of days? Or here's what I really need. We're out of something at home. Could you leave a carton of milk on? You know, people want to do, but you might have to be specific with what they do.
We have a caller who wants to get into our discussion. Let's bring her in. It's Jean. She's calling from St. Louis County. Jean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm really glad you're bringing this topic up. I've been a caregiver who's had to kind of navigate the system from both my husband and a sister. And I have knowledge of the system. I'm a nurse. And I was just really confounded by the obstacles you run into. And if you don't know who to ask, who to talk to, I just can't imagine the hurdles and how difficult it must be. The other thing is that the health care, you have to be careful that you don't rattle the cage too much or it impacts the patient. Oh, there's that person again who's not happy with the care. It does happen. I hate to say it, but it does. And it's just a really delicate balance. I feel sorry for anyone who doesn't have a medical background or understanding of how things should work.
Jean, thank you so much for the call. Definitely, may I ask you to respond to that?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. And you're at a time, it's traumatic for people when their loved one is suffering or dying. It's hard then to make things happen, to keep your faculties. It's a tall order. It's very, very difficult, and I have empathy for anybody who has to go through it.
Jamie, we have alluded to something that that I think is very important too, and that is the confidence of the caregiver is very important, because if the patient senses that the confidence is not there, it's going to have an impact on the patient.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, if I were the patient, I would want somebody to empathize, too, with who I continue to be as a human being. I'm not just tubes and diagnoses. I'm a person. And so certainly the caregiver knows that because of what you are in their life. Mm. Teaching that to the medical professionals around you, some have it and some don't. You can't teach empathy, but you can ask people to be kinder, more thoughtful about what the patient is experiencing, as well as all these complicated medical procedures and definitions and diagnoses.
I may be going a little off our point here, but because it's part of a public debate right now, I'll just raise it and see how you want to respond to it. I'll start with you, Jamie. And that's this whole death with dignity movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, this mm-hmm. does come up. I don't know if it did in your case or not, Debbie, but how should people deal with this in terms of discussing it and working out how this should be dealt with?
That's a very complicated topic.
Yeah.
You know, it's an and situation. Whenever I've had people in my life, personally and professionally, where somebody has been ill for a long time and you get the sense that they're just ready to be done with the burden that they perceive as being put on their loved ones, because that's huge. I worked with a patient who was dying, and his greatest fear was how he was burdening the people around him, his children and his wife. And he did finally say, I'm just ready. It had been so long. We have to respect that we want them here forever, and they're not leading quality of life anymore, and there are no medical interventions that are going to make that happen. So if it goes past that point, really listening to what somebody's ready for.
Debbie, how would you respond to that? I'm sure this is something that you've thought about, whether in your own case or certainly in your teaching.
Yeah, death with dignity and respect is paramount. I mean, to all parties involved. And I was determined for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So it was forefront on, you know, it was on my radar. I'm going to treat him with dignity and respect and not let him think he's any kind of burden by any stretch of the imagination, that nothing is too much to ask, that I'm here with you till the bitter end. And it's easy because you're my friend and you're my husband. And, oh, no, that's in my book, Dignity and Respect's Paramount. And I model that in the book so that other people would see that, other caregivers, and how important it is, because when you're dying, you're stripped of your dignity. I mean, here's him. He was a huge man that was down to 115 pounds in a diaper with incontinence, feeding tubes, pacemaker defibrillator unit, losing a pound a day, wasting away. There's no way I wouldn't treat him with honor. I mean, it's just humanity kind of thing for me.
I can't imagine going through that and watching a loved one.
Yeah, it was 7 years worth. They said he had 3 months, and he lived 7 years.
Mm. What about the issue of advanced directives, then, and getting financial affairs in order?
Advanced directives, I learned, are their guides. But as long as a patient can speak for him or herself, they can be null and void. And Frank was reluctant to do a living will. He agreed if I said I would do one too. And he, the way we made out the will, he wanted everything that we could possibly do to keep him alive. He didn't want to die. He was afraid to die. So he bounced back and forth with what he wanted in the living will. He didn't want a DNR, do not resuscitate order. He wanted them to resuscitate as many times as possible. But when it, towards the end, then his rheumatologist talked him into going for a DNR. He went for it for a little while, but then he changed his mind again. It was really, it was tough bouncing around. And then, but luckily, we had practitioners who would listen to him, and the staff at the hospital and rehab center would honor his wishes. He asked one point to have his pacemaker defibrillator turned off and the tube removed, that he wanted to die, then changed his mind the next day. So what I learned was those are guides. From my practical experience, and not legal, you know, binding legal documents.
Sure. Any advice, Jamie, that you would have along these lines?
Just, again, listening to the human side of that. When we talk about a DNR, what are you afraid of? And maybe we can talk to, if there's a hospital social worker or somebody who, a chaplain, can talk with you about the spiritual side of death and what people tend to experience and what are you most afraid of? What do you need to hear from the people who are around you that you're leaving in order to give you permission to let go a little bit of what's frightening you? It can be scary, and yet what I hear and all the reading I do is that it's so peaceful. Mm. And, you know, the idea of being reunited can be brought up, and what will make it less scary for that person.
Our time is winding down, but Debbie, I can see why you chose Jamie to help you through all of this.
Yeah, she's been excellent for me. I suppose we've had maybe 4 or 5 sessions. Mm-hmm. The reason I sought Jamie out was because she specializes in grief. I had gone to other therapists that were generalist, that their experience with grief wasn't their area of expertise. And what happened was, just a year ago in spring, I lost 2 sisters and a nephew in a car accident. Well, I lost 3 people suddenly. And I was struck by my reaction. I didn't cry. And I thought, I lost 2 sisters suddenly and I'm not crying? Mm-hmm. I wanted to find out what that was about. So I sought out a grief specialist, and she's been excellent.
Thank you for that.
Is there one simple piece of advice you can give us, Jamie, about dealing with grief? A basic?
Again, listening to yourself and being kind and compassionate to yourself and knowing that grieving is a process. It's not an event. This is not something that we're going to get an answer to in one session. Forgiving the fact that you're never going to be the same person that you were before your loss. A lot of people I see are struggling so much with the idea of, why can't I just get back to who I was before? And you're not. You've been changed by this. The other thing is, I'm not a grief expert. I'm not the grief expert. My client is the expert on their grief. And sure. I think that works, letting them teach me what they need.
That makes a lot of sense. One final thought, Debbie, go ahead.
The one thing that struck me in my relationship with Jamie is that she gives me unconditional advocacy, and I'm allowed active participation in my grief, as one should have active participation in their health care. So it's a nice relationship.
Well, I hope this discussion today has helped people who are listening who may be facing or dealing with this issue right now. I want to thank you so much, Deborah Phelps, for being with us, professor of sociology at Fontbonne, author of Frank's Arms, Stories and Lessons from a Caregiver and Patient Advocate. Jamie Centner, licensed clinical social worker. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.